We would like to take a moment to thank our sponsor, Preborn. When a mother meets her baby on an ultrasound and hears their heartbeat, it's a divine connection, and the majority of the time, she will choose life. But she can't do it without our help. Preborn needs us, the pro-life community, to come alongside her. One ultrasound is just $28. To donate, dial #250 and say the keyword baby, or visit preborn.com.
Jenna Ellis in the Morning on American Family Radio.
I love talking about the things of God because of truth and the biblical worldview.
The U.S. Constitution obligates our government to preserve and protect the rights that our founders recognize come from God, our Creator, not our government. I believe that scripture in the Bible is very clear that God is the one that raised up each of you, and God has allowed us to be brought here to this specific moment in time.
This is Jenna Ellis in the Morning.
Good morning. Good morning. It is Tuesday, March 12th, and a lot going on in the world, especially Capitol Hill this morning. Special Counsel Robert Hur to testify on findings from Biden classified documents investigation. That's the headline from Fox News this morning. So he is expected to testify in front of the House Judiciary Committee on Capitol Hill today at 10 a.m. on his findings following the months of investigating President Biden's mishandling of classified document records. And of course, this comes in tandem with the DOJ also prosecuting former President Trump for mishandling of classified records. So it'll be very interesting to see if any of this testimony is actually helpful to President Trump in his defense on those indictment charges. And the special counsel, Robert Hur, as you recall, he said in his report that Biden did not have a good memory, and he described Biden as a, quote, sympathetic, well-meaning elderly man with a poor memory. And he reached the conclusion that no criminal charges were warranted in the matter, basically because he said in the report, we considered that at trial, Mr. Biden would likely present himself to a jury as he did in our interview of him as a sympathetic, well-meaning elderly man with a poor memory. Based on our direct interactions and observations of him, he is someone with whom many jurors would want to identify a reasonable doubt. It would be difficult to convince a jury that should they convict him, by then a former president well into his 80s, of a serious felony that requires a mental state of willfulness. So, of course, the members of the House Judiciary Committee are going to want to follow up on that on a number of fronts. But Representative Andy Biggs just was on Fox and Friends this morning, and this is what he had to say in terms of what he would like to follow up on with the special counsel.
We're going to focus on Joe Biden's mental capacity, whether if he is so bad off that you can't prosecute him. Should he be running the greatest nation in the history of the world? And can he do it, carefully with probity, et cetera? Second thing is, we're going to explore all the cavalier ways that Joe Biden left classified documents all over the place. Look, he left code words at a party that he was at up in New York. I mean, so we're going to explore that. And then we're going to get to the third thing that I think is important is, was this willful and intentional? And I think we're going to find that it was willful and intentional. When I say that, was he telling people about this classified information? And the actual reality is he was. And he knew it was classified, and he knew he didn't have authority. He was trained in it for 50 years, good grief, and he's out there passing classified information around. And that's clear violations of the law.
So again, that was Representative Andy Biggs. And what's interesting to me in terms of the congressional hearing, because Congress does not bring charges, they are not the executive branch, they're not the Department of Justice, and so they could recommend to the DOJ, but we've already had a special counsel. He's literally the one that will testify in front of Congress. And so what is the purpose of this particular hearing? Well, I think a couple of things. One is that there is still this kind of pending open probe into impeachment that Congress, with the Republican majority, a very slim majority in the House, is considering considering, and also there could be some potential legislative solutions that may be proffered by some of these members following this type of hearing. And so it's not so much that it's the special counsel Robert Hur defending his recommendations in the report and the declining of the DOJ to prosecute, because that is within prosecutorial discretion. And while Congress has some oversight in terms of some elements of other branches of government, it's not so much that they're questioning him, saying, well, we think differently in terms of your decision to decline to prosecute, and so we have any kind of authority to tell you to reconsider that. So in terms of prosecutorial discretion, that's not really what this is about. And I think that some of the mainstream media headlines are a little bit fuzzy on that. And so really, I think what the committee is going to be probing is whether or not this is consistent with their own investigation of President Biden. Because when this report initially came out, it was like, you can't have your cake and eat it too. You can't say, well, Biden is so weak and old and frail and his memory is so bad that he's not mentally competent to stand trial, but yet for all of this, but yet he is mentally competent to continue in the presidency, and somehow it's not a dereliction of his constitutional obligations. So all of that is going to be very interesting in terms of the fine lines, but we also do have a little bit of the opening statements that Special Counsel Robert Hur is going to say. And so he said in his prepared opening testimony to the House Judiciary Committee, he will say, and this is according to Fox News reports, his report reflects my best effort to explain why I declined to recommend charging President Biden for his mishandling of classified records. My assessment in the report about the relevance of the president's memory was necessary and accurate and fair. Most importantly, what I wrote is what I believe the evidence shows and what I expect jurors would perceive and believe. I did not sanitize my explanation, nor did I disparage the president unfairly. I explained to the attorney general my decision and the reasons for it. That is what I was required to do. He goes on to say, or will say in these prepared opening remarks, I analyze the evidence as prosecutors routinely do by assessing its strengths and weaknesses, including by anticipating the ways in which the president's defense lawyers might poke holes in the government's case. If there were a trial, and seek to persuade jurors that the government could not prove his guilt beyond a reasonable doubt. Hur will also say there has been a lot of attention paid to the language in the report about the president's memory, so let me say a few words about that. My task was to determine whether the president retained or disclosed national defense information, quote-unquote, willfully, meaning knowingly and with the intent to do something the law forbids. I could not make that determination without assessing the president's state of mind. So you may be thinking, you know, why would the special counsel try to go and anticipate the ways that his defense lawyers, the president's defense lawyers, might try to poke holes? Because isn't that what defense attorneys do all the time? And still we have prosecutors that routinely, every day, charge criminal defendants. Well, that's true. And yet, if a prosecutor declines to charge a case because they believe that they can't make their case and they can't survive what is kind of colloquially referred to in the criminal defense world as a halftime motion or the motion for directed verdict, to say that the prosecutor did not meet their burden of proof and their burden of production. Those are two things that are the burdens that in the criminal process the prosecutor always carries. That burden is never shifted to the defense. This is why criminal defendants in our, what was formerly great justice system, never requires the defendant to prove their innocence. It's that the prosecutor has to prove their case. And so what's interesting to me about how Robert Hur, in at least these remarks, is going about this and so emphasizing how a jury might perceive Biden, he's emphasizing the jury a lot more than he is emphasizing the lack of a prosecutor's ability to meet their burden of proof or burden of production. And I find that really fascinating because, generally speaking, even if a prosecutor thinks that a defendant might be sympathetic to a jury, or, you know, they might get a great defense lawyer that will poke holes in their case, that doesn't necessarily stop a prosecutor and say, well, it's going to be an uphill battle and we're going to have to convince a jury and this is a super sympathetic defendant, so we're going to decline on that basis. More often than not, the reason that prosecutors will decline to pursue a case is if they can represent to the court that they cannot meet their burden as a matter of law. And say, so for example, if a witness, their only witness, their star witness, recants or has conflicting testimony, or there's some issue with that type of evidence, then they say, you know, that was our only method by which to meet and fulfill our burden of proof is through this one witness. And because that witness is no longer available, no longer reliable, something is going on with that, then we are now no longer able to meet our burden of proof. So we're going to dismiss the case. And this, you know, sometimes occasionally happens after charging. Or if a prosecutor sits down with the case file and the evidence as the investigators have brought to them, and a prosecutor is determining whether or not to charge, and charging decisions, of course, you know, that varies a little bit by jurisdiction, but when a prosecutor is looking at charging, then, you know, they have to determine, can they meet their burden as a matter of law? And so I don't know if any of the lawyers, like Jim Jordan, for example, who is on the House Judiciary Committee, if they're going to probe that specific question, and I would love them to, frankly, because I think it's fascinating that her is focusing so much on a jury's perception, which is very subjective, and it really doesn't matter at the end of the day what the jury does or doesn't perceive. That's solely the province of the jury as the fact finder and whether or not they find a witness sympathetic. His focus really should be on the legal issues, and as a matter of law, can you fulfill your burden? I mean, if I was on the House Judiciary Committee today, that would be the question that I would want to ask Robert Hur is, well, did you make a determination that you could not fulfill your burden of proof or your burden of production as a matter of law, representing that in a federal court, and that's why you decline the charge? Like, why are you so focused on the jury? So this seems to be potentially a little bit of word gamesman's, you know, kind of wordsmithing a little bit. Lawyers are kind of famous for doing that. But this is where it's very important, the public's perception of this, of course, because, you know, for probably most of you who are listening to this program who aren't lawyers, wouldn't necessarily draw that kind of distinction. And so by the headlines and by the way that Hur is crafting his report, he's making it sound like he is going where the evidence showed, and he made these determinations, you know, based on the law and based on a very objective judgment. But the focus on the jury rather than the focus on the law here, I think, is misplaced. But we're going to have to see what else comes out, because, of course, this is just a couple of paragraphs of his opening statement. Again, this is going to be at 10 a.m. Eastern time that Hur is going to testify in front of the House Judiciary Committee. And hopefully the members on Capitol Hill are going to follow up with more than kind of those pointed political questions. But the intent is likely going to be driven not so much toward the prosecution of the case or the declination to prosecute, but rather on where does the House Judiciary Committee go and where does the rest of the congressional majority go in terms of their open impeachment inquiry against Joe Biden. And of course, the Democrats are going to come back and say, this is a presidential election year. This is, you know, this is messing with the election and this is tampering with democracy and, you know, all this kind of stuff, which, of course, they didn't care about during their first sham impeachment of former President Trump, which was in the fall of 2019, heading into then an election year when he was the incumbent, like Joe Biden is now, the current sitting president. And so none none of this ever matters to the Democrats and to the left. They're able to do whatever they want. They don't care about political optics. They always say, you know, whatever they do is justified. But if Republicans actually have a rationale for it, then, of course, it's never justified. And it's always about optics. And then we go back and forth and round and around. And that's politics, right? So I'm going to be very interested to see how the special counsel Robert Hur answers some of these questions and what questions he asks. So hopefully that gave you a little bit more of a metric and a way to view this, not just from a political perspective, but from analyzing some of the legal issues. So it'll be really fascinating, and we will be right back with more here on Jenna Ellis in the Morning.
Welcome back to Jenna Ellis in the Morning on American Family Radio.
Welcome back. And you may recall that CVS and Walgreens are going to start selling the abortion pill over the counter. And we had Abby Johnson on talking about that. I think it was last week. And so you can go and find that and all other prior programs of Jenna Ellis in the Morning, and also every other show that we have here on AFR at AFR.net. But this now coming from the Daily Wire, CVS requires participants in leadership program to swear fealty to DEI, of course, standing for diversity, equity, and inclusion. So Daily Wire says a required leadership training program at retail pharmacy giant CVS asks participants to confess their privilege as a part of a diversity, equity, and inclusion action plan, as well as pledge their allyship. That's like become a leftist new word, I guess, allyship, to various social justice causes, according to documents obtained by the Daily Wire. The training titled Creating a DEI Action Plan was given last month to employees in the General Management Development Program, an accelerator program that prepares CVS professionals for careers in management. The training is labeled GMDP Rotation 2 Curriculum and demands that participants conduct a personal audit of their biases and commit to pushing the DEI agenda as allies. So much to unpack there, because, of course, this is just furthering evidence that CVS not only is in tandem with the leftist big pharma agenda in terms of abortion and trying to have all kinds of abortion access over the counter that is just medically unsafe for women. But now this is giving us an insight into what their overall management perspective and style is on the leftist worldview. And to say that, and this, I love when they call this curriculum, you know, because it makes it sound like this is very educational. This is very this is very elite. There's a lot of intelligence behind this, and it's very thoughtful. And, you know, you need to do a personal audit of your biases. And of course, this is never going to be that a personal audit of your biases is that. Oh, yeah, that's right. I should not be saying that men can become women and women can become men. My bias is antithetical to reality. You know, that's never part of any of these programs. It's always designed to force the conservative to conform to whatever the leftist agenda is pushing. That's all that this is ever doing. And when you pledge your allyship, I've loved a lot of the commentators, like James Lindsay. A lot of you know that I really think very highly of his work. Yes, I know he's an atheist, but the fact that he can look into, you know, a lot of these leftist worldviews and articulate exactly what's going on. General revelation still applies to atheists, and he can still be correct on all of these issues. And when he talks about the flags that people wear, it literally is trying to have a view of sovereignty like a nation would do around these queer issues. And it's so bizarre that people will, that they on purpose are trying to harness this type of language and call it allyship and call it almost like a sovereignty and say, you know, you are part of your own unique little sovereign domain over there. And you to the extent that you literally have a flag. But this is what the leftist agenda is doing. And this is why we have to be so very careful what terms we use. And I had a listener a week or so ago, you know, who wrote in and said, don't call it the LGBTQ agenda, you know, call it for what it is, which is, you know, this the horrendous nonsense of the left and, you know, the queer theory and all of this. Well, I call it the LGBTQ agenda because that's what it is. It really is an agenda by the left to queer society. And that we know what we're talking about because of a descriptive term. But we do need to be careful how we use terms, how we articulate them, just like the left uses and manipulates the term social justice or Black Lives Matter or even now Christian nationalism. I mean, that term is trying to be harnessed by the left to promote this kind of label on right-wing extremists. In their words, they want to basically label all conservatives as right-wing extremists and have us label ourselves in a way that they can not only create the term, but then define it however they prefer to use it, just like social justice. I mean, do we believe in society? Do we believe in justice as Christians? Absolutely. But social justice, no, not in the way that the left manipulates that term. So when they're using all of these things, pledging your allyship and a personal audit of biases, I mean, all of this nonsense is how they try to infiltrate not only institutions in America, but also corporate America by forcing, if you want to go further in your career, then you're going to have to assent to all of this DEI woke nonsense in your management style. And you have to yield to these flags, basically, and the rainbow flag and all of this. So you know, CVS is just, if you can go to a different pharmacy, I would encourage you to do that because we do have the ability to pick and choose where we go. And of course, as Americans, we can't always get away from everything. And we need to be careful where we spend our dollars, how we do that. And that, of course, is a personal conviction. But we need to be aware of these things and then decide for ourselves how we want to participate. And as the Apostle Paul said, be in the world, but not of the world. All right, so there was an interesting piece in Politico as well this week, how raw milk went from a Whole Foods staple to a conservative signal. So speaking of signals and words that we use, so our good friend Raw Egg Nationalist, who is anonymous on media, so goes by the moniker Raw Egg Nationalist, joins me for this segment. And so Raw Egg, thanks so much for joining. And I guess just kind of give us an overview of why this is so significant, that Politico would kind of dedicate a piece to this and what they mean by a conservative signal.
It's a pleasure to be back with you, Jenna. Thank you for having me. So I would be the first person to say, look, food is political. In 2024, there's no doubt about it. Food and health and fitness are political. I mean, that's my whole spiel, my whole everything, you know, so much of what I write about is about the fact that precisely there is now a clear dividing line between right and left on issues of physical fitness, of health and diet. And this thing about milk in particular has been it's been around for a while. So there, you know, at the beginning of the Trump presidency, early sort of 2016, 2017, 2018, we had a slew of articles from in the New York Times. There were press releases put out by PETA and all sorts of other people saying, you know, what milk is now a symbol of white supremacy. And, you know, white supremacists are chugging milk as a symbolic display of their politics. Now, that was because supposedly, you know, people of European descent have the highest rate of lactose tolerance in the world. And so chugging milk is a way of showing, you know, that the European people are different from the rest, etc. So there's all this political stuff that's sort of been that surrounded milk and as a supposed symbol of white supremacy. But this article in Politico about raw milk is basically, it's about disinformation. It's about health disinformation. That's how it's framed. And what they're basically trying to say is that the growing movement, especially on the right, of people and of state legislatures in particular, pushing for the legalization of raw milk consumption is a sign of health disinformation. You know, it's people are drinking raw milk and are trying to promote the consumption of raw milk as a way of sticking their middle finger up at the scientific establishment, basically. That's the premise of it. So they're not saying that people are actually drinking raw milk because it's good for them, because it tastes delicious and it is and, you know, does both of those things. They're saying that this is actually just it's on a par basically with refusing the COVID vaccinations, etc. It's part of a broader trend towards people being skeptical of the scientific establishment.
And you were so right, and I love the way that you frame this, Raw Egg, that food is political now, because we're seeing that all of the health issues and even what the left wants to term as healthy, and you look at the covers of magazine and it's a clearly overweight or obese person, and they're saying, oh, that's totally healthy and this is great and, you know, do what works for you, and yet then they want to shame conservatives and say that milk is a symbol of white supremacy. I mean, all of these things are for what purpose then? So that they can control what we consume, and this goes into kind of a bigger issue of like GMOs and then ultimately kind of funnels into big pharma. I mean, is this kind of where we're going?
I think there's very definitely an aspect of that. I mean, I think when we're talking about things like fat acceptance and all this kind of stuff, I think what we need to understand fundamentally is that this is the way that the left works. The left works by building a sort of ever more diverse coalition of people, by expand, you know, that's how the left gets more and more members, is it expands its sort of, it becomes more and more capacious, more and more inclusive of more and more people. And of course, people are getting fatter and fatter and unhealthier and unhealthier. And so, of course, to build that coalition in the late 20th, early 21st centuries, then the left has to be accepting of people who are overweight, who are unhealthy. So that's part of it. That's part of, I think, of the leftist, of understanding the leftist politics behind this, is that it is partly about the way that leftism just builds a kind of coalition encompassing more and more people. But the corporate aspect of it, yes, is very interesting, and something that I write about at length, wrote about in my book, The Eggs Benedict Option in particular, is that corporations control huge amount of the food supply, not only in America but globally too, and they're consolidating their control with new products. That's what all of these plant-based alternatives are about. That's what lab-grown meat is about. Raw milk is produced largely by small dairies, small farmers, people like Amos Miller, I think it is, this chap in Idaho or Illinois, who's being persecuted by the FDA for selling raw milk. I mean, he's being crucified for it. It's small producers serving local communities, providing them with staple foods that they want, that they feel are essential for their health, and that is precisely the kind of local food system that these corporate players don't want to exist. They want you to have to buy your dairy from them. And if you actually look at the history of pasteurization as a process, you know, it's all tied up with industrialization and urbanization. You can't understand pasteurization, the spread of pasteurization, without thinking about, you know, the spread of urbanization, the growth of industrial power and corporations. It was a way historically for corporations actually to rig the game in their favor, because suddenly when you have pasteurization regulations, small producers can't keep up because they don't have the industrial equipment. They don't have the laboratories to do the testing. And so it's yet another barrier for entry into the dairy market for small producers. And so that was part of a very early wave of consolidation within the dairy industry, within farming, and it's continuing today. And yes, I mean, I think fundamentally you do have to understand that there is an element of corporate control. There's leftist politics involved as well. There's this polarization between left and right, but it's also about corporate control of the food supply.
And I'm speaking with Raw Egg Nationalist. You can follow him on social media. He is an Anon, which is why we call him Raw Egg. Thomas Massey, who's one of my favorite people in Congress, understands this and understands how, you know, the FDA is supposedly, you know, they would say, well, this is to make sure that, you know, we're protecting the consumer, and this is all about making sure that everybody follows all of these guidelines and all of this. But in 2021, he and a number of other representatives initiated the bipartisan bill to allow interstate traffic of raw milk, which is really interesting. And his press release said it's legal to drink raw milk in 50 states. It's legal to sell raw milk in 38 states. Congress has never passed a ban on raw milk, yet the Food and Drug Administration, the FDA, issued a regulation banning the interstate sale of raw milk in capitulation to a lawsuit that was decided in 1986. And so this just shows how, at least in America, the over-federalizing of these attempts to use and manipulate the Interstate Commerce Clause, or is really what it is, is trying purposefully to diminish the ability of farmers and organics and all of this under this guise of the FDA trying to help and to say, you know, we want to protect the consumer. And so a lot of these, I think, with Thomas Massey, of course, having his own farm, a lot of these are really interesting. And I think it's fascinating how this is not a big topic on mainstream media, yet this goes to the heart of what we consume and what we eat and the provisions of you know, how we can get our nutrition. And so we're already out of time, and I want to have you back, Raw Egg, to discuss this further. But it's a fascinating article. And of course, you know, Politico is, you have to read that with a grain of salt, of course. But you know, no pun intended there on you know, some of the some of the consuming, you know, the spicy of food. But the title is How Raw Milk Went From a Whole Food Staple to a Conservative Signal. And you can also read The Eggs Benedict Option, which is a Raw Egg Nationalist book. And we'll be right back with more here on Jenna Ellis in the Morning. Last year, because of you, Preborn's network of clinics saw over 58,000 babies saved. Thank you to all who made this possible. Let's celebrate these precious babies. When Charlotte found out she was pregnant, she was 7 weeks along. In the back of her mind, she thought abortion was the best solution. But after hearing her baby's heartbeat and seeing her beautiful baby on an ultrasound, she chose life. Her heart is filled with gratitude for all of you who made this possible. Each of these babies are truly miraculous, and every day, Preborn celebrates 200 miracles. $28 a month can be the difference between the life and the death of a child. When a mother meets her baby on ultrasound and hears their heartbeat, it's a divine connection that doubles the baby's chance at life. Let's join together and help mothers choose life. Just dial #250 and say the keyword baby. That's #250 baby, or visit preborn.com. That's preborn.com.
Welcome back to Jenna Ellis in the Morning on American Family Radio.
Welcome back. And in the last segment, before we had Raw Egg Nationalist on, I was talking about CVS and their management program that requires allyship to all of these woke, nonsensical ideas. And we were talking about how the rainbow flag is now attempting to make a nation out of this ridiculously false worldview that is from the pit of hell. And this headline, Pete Buttigieg, who you'll recall does nothing other than be gay in the White House. I mean, he's literally the diversity hire for that purpose. But Buttigieg's quote-unquote husband recites the LGBTQ pledge with gay youth camp in a viral video. I pledge my heart to the rainbow of the not so typical gay camp. So his husband, quote unquote, because we know that, you know, of course, homosexual marriage is not actually a thing. But, you know, this headline, of course, the U.S. Transportation Secretary Pete Buttigieg's husband, Chasten, leads children in a modified pledge of allegiance to the rainbow flag at what he described as a not so typical gay camp in a viral social media video. And it's, I pledge my heart to the rainbow of the not so typical gay camp, one camp full of pride, indivisible, with affirmation and equal rights for all. So joining me now to discuss this more is our very dear friend Alex McFarland, of course, is a worldview theologian and scholar and co-host of Exploring the Word right here on American Family Radio. And Alex, this is just appalling, but this is just a continuation of the leftist agenda that wants to make the worship of self and self-expression and our own modification of reality the highest power and worship rather than God, our creator.
Well, if anybody doubted that we're in intense spiritual warfare, I don't think it could be questioned now. Would you agree?
Absolutely. 100%.
So I got a term, folks. We have to be up to speed on nomenclature. And since last year, the left has criticized those of us who love God and country, and they're trying to, you know, marginalized Christians and conservatives and constitutionalists as Christian nationalists. Jenna, we've got to be on the lookout for the gay nationalists. Seriously, you know, in America, you can be what you want to be, believe what you want to believe, but we have been a constitutional republic founded on the worldview of Judeo-Christian morality. Now, homosexuality and the, you know, big, well-funded gay agenda mitigates against that. In fact, the gay agenda can only take root in the minds of people if the Judeo-Christian, the reality that humans have known from time immemorial, if that is destroyed and suppressed. And just like in the State of the Union last Thursday when President Biden, I don't know if people caught this, but when Biden said, "Trans Americans, I've got your back." Well, transgenderism is based on a worldview that is utterly incompatible with the U.S. Constitution. Homosexuality is utterly incompatible with not only human biology, human morality, but Christianity. So, we're in a spiritual battle. We have prayer. We have truth. We have the ability to influence others. But Jenna, I just hope not only the average citizen, but Christians in particular, realize the absolute intensity of the battle in which not only souls hang in the balance, but the future of our country itself.
So well said, as always, Alex McFarland. And you're absolutely right that these worldviews and the way that the leftists want to reshape America is fundamentally incompatible with our U.S. Constitution, which was built on the mandate and the premise of the Declaration, which is that our rights come from God, our Creator. And so when we're talking about natural rights, marriage as a natural right is between one man and one woman. It's everything that the left wants to do in all of these social agendas. And even when they're talking about abortion, when they're talking about contraceptives, when they're talking about gay marriage, when they're talking about queer theory, I mean, all of these things that are termed and couched as social issues are unnatural by definition. And so they're intentionally wanting to distort and pervert the not only the Constitution, but the entire premise of the Judeo-Christian worldview that underpins and it is at the founding of our entire society. And so what does this do then when we are now, you know, 250 plus years later and we're seeing how the left, including Joe Biden and as their leader, basically, who are trying purposefully to openly take the country in a different direction?
Well, this is where, you know, citizens have to understand every generation has a God-ordained role to play. I mean, Washington and the Continental Army fought at Valley Forge. They gave their lives. I mean, they really did. I mean, the soldiers, the Brits would track Washington's soldiers because their feet would freeze and they didn't have adequate boots and clothes oftentimes, and the British soldiers would follow the blood in the snow. And I mean, for one thing, Jenna, my heart is moved when I realize the incredible price of life and effort and pain and prayers, what was invested to birth a nation based on rights from God. And so here we are today in 2024, and there are a lot of people, and they don't know what it took to give us freedom and prosperity and stability. So the citizens today, our God-ordained assignment is to try to restore and preserve something God, like Washington said, when Washington was inaugurated, among his remarks, George Washington, our first president, said, "The sacred fire of liberty has been entrusted to the American people." To everyone listening, I want to say, to be an American, God has entrusted that to us. It's not automatically preserved. Every generation must pray, must stay informed, must influence others, must vote. And Jenna, let me call out to my pastor brothers out there. I've pastored two churches and at some point hope to return to the pastorate. And I've got to say this, that any pastor that is not using his platform and his pulpit to speak with decisive clarity, brother pastors, you had better mobilize your parishioners to stand for God and country, or you are going to answer to God for it. Pastors, this is no time to play it safe, to be silent, to be milquetoast cowards. I'm calling, in fact, begging my fellow ministers out there, and there are 500,000 that speak into the lives of 100 million citizens a week. Pastors, come on. You need to tell your parishioners that we're watching the loss of America. We're watching the loss of the opportunity to live out the Great Commission. We are duty-bound to tell our flock homosexuality is a sin. It will never be right in the eyes of Almighty God. There is no such thing as gay marriage. No one is born transgender. Now, look, every sinner can be saved if they will repent and turn to Jesus. But, Jenna, a little bit of the urgency in my voice and even frustration is due to the fact that we got here. We are where we are. People often say to me, they'll say, oh, well, you know, the colleges went liberal. Yeah, we know that for 75 years. But sinners sin. That's no surprise. We got where we are in large measure because of five decades of silence from American pulpits. Mm. It's got to change.
Absolutely. And this reminds me of the documentary, The Letter to the American Church, from our good friend Eric Metaxas. And I would so highly recommend that. and commend that to everyone who is listening. Take that to your pastor and ask them to show it. It's streaming for free at lettertotheamericanchurch.com for churches. And this really does encourage exactly what you just said, Alex, that we have to take our God-given moment in time and in history to stand up for the principles of truth, for the gospel of Christ. And I think for far too long, we have had the blessings of liberty to such an extent that we've almost become complacent in America, in a large part because we haven't faced some of the challenges that other Christians have across the world or throughout history. And this is our moment in time where we do have to stand up. And of course, yes, you have to pick your battles. And it's not saying that, you know, absolutely everything is a hill to die on. But the gospel of Christ is absolutely a hill to die on. And that is absolutely something that we have to stand firm on as Christians. And we have to ensure that we do not lose the blessings of liberty because our generation failed to stand up as Christians. And,
and
looking at some of this, like what they're trying to do with this queer theory. I mean, Alex, we are going to be faced as Christians and as the church with so many victims of queer theory. And I don't think that the church is ready to handle that right now.
Oh my goodness. Well, no, they're not. And, you know, just like Buttigieg's sodomite lover, I'm not going to say it's his husband because that's his oxymoron. That's contradictory. But just like they've got the LGBTQ trans indoctrination camps. And by the way, isn't that a contradiction? I mean, the left says people are born gay, and yet children have to be coached and groomed into homosexuality and transgender orientation, but they are gay nationalists. And so, you know, if they're going to call us Christian nationalists, because I'm a Christian and I care about the country, does that make me a bad guy? I don't think so. But the gay nationalists, like Buttigieg and all the others, folks, it's like the San Francisco gay men's chorus, you know, sang about several years ago. They sang this song, We're Coming for Your Children. Do you remember that, Jenna? That was probably about 4 or 5 years ago. They put a video on YouTube, We're Coming for Your Children. And, you know, some people laughed and they were very dismissive. Oh, you know, that's a joke. And some of the people in that gay choir, they said, you know, it is not a joke. You know, just laugh all you want. But in the public schools, in the pop media, in indoctrination camps, they want kids on the bandwagon with their worldview. Well, you know, I do 6 youth camps. We'll have 1,200 youth in camps this summer. By the website, just my own website, which is alexmcfarland.com. You know, we're doing events, publishing, broadcasting. I'll be doing a major event next week in Plainview, Texas. The Lord is moving. I don't want to be all doom and gloom, Jenna, because there is even, I'm getting emails from pastors and parents and even teenagers. Teenagers will get their parents to drive 2 and 3 hours to our conferences because kids want to know what is true. And I let me just say to every church and, you know, adult that has entree into the life of a young person, middle schoolers, high schoolers, they really do care about truth. But very often, they've not had a trustworthy, accessible adult who knows what they believe and is willing to, you know, share it. But, Jenna, I make no apology. I'm a Christian. My home is in heaven. I'm a believer in Jesus. But my home here on earth is the United States of America. It's been entrusted to us by Almighty God. It's the greatest nation in history. Well, second only to Israel under King Solomon, but we've got to love America. Everybody listening, pray for the country, stay informed, listen to AFR, influence others, vote and vote godly. And that's not a hard thing to figure out this year, how to vote godly. And our nation could be saved, but it's going to take participation from every single one of us.
Yes, and we cannot derelict that duty or just complain, Alex McFarland, without having a solution as well. And that was one of the best pieces of advice. One of my mentors, actually, in the law and also in conservative policy, told me years ago and said, don't just be one of the Christians that complains, be a Christian that points out a problem but has a solution and is actually Amen. Affirmatively advancing that solution. So Alex McFarland, really appreciate it. I could always talk to you for so much longer, but appreciate you joining for this last segment. Listen to Alex McFarland on Exploring the Word every weekday at 3 p.m. Central Time. That's 4 p.m. Eastern. And you can always reach me and my team, Jenna, at afr.net. And as always, make it a great day for the Lord and promote the truth of the gospel of Christ in all of your spheres of influence today.
The views and opinions expressed in this broadcast may not necessarily reflect those of the American Family Association or American Family Radio.
We'd like to thank our sponsors, including Preborn. Preborn has rescued over 200,000 babies from abortion, and every day their network clinics rescue 200 babies' lives. Will you join Preborn in loving and supporting young moms in crisis? Save a life today. Go to preborn.com.